This is Croydon Radio, and this is Poets Anonymous. July by Boris Pasternak. There is a ghost who haunts our home and paces overhead all day, while shadows flitter through the attic, a goblin's here to range and stray. He'll fuss futilely everywhere and interfere with all you do, creeping a dressing gown to bed or snatch the tablecloth from you. Nor wipes his feet upon the mat, but bursts in with a gusty whirl, and spins the curtain to the ceiling as though it were a dancing girl. Who's this uncivil mischief-maker, this two-faced ghost who dogs our ways? He is our temporary lodger, here for his summer holidays. We give the whole house up to him just for his momentary stay. July of storms, air of July, has rented rooms with us today. July, who scatters from his clothes the fluff of dandelion spray. July, who comes in through the window and mutters loudly all the way, his hair untidy and dishevelled, but redolent of linden, rye, perfume of grass and beet and dill, this meadow-sweet air of July.
Thank you very much. That was Peter Evans reading July, written by Boris Pasternak, who you probably know wrote Dr. Zhivago, which was one heck of a film. On this day in 1928, the first colour TV broadcast was made in London by John Logie Baird. But here in Croydon Radio Studio, we are still hand-cranking the radio generator. On this day in 1974, John Crow Renson, American educator, scholar, literary critic, poet, essayist, editor, and the founder of the New Criticism School of Literary Criticism, he died. Very much alive are our two guests, Nick Aldridge and Gilly Robick. Nick is a master of the sonnet form, and soon is to have his first collection, Playing with the Pieces, published by Palewell Press. And Gilly Robick, puppeteer, voice artist, designer, maker, director and teacher, has just had her first collection called Swimming Through Marble, clever that, published by Live Cannon. And both guests have sonnets to answer to Shakespeare in Live Cannon's anthology 154. And Gilly replies to Shakespeare's sonnet 138 and Nick to sonnet 149. Now, to maybe hear some more of their sonnets, hear from our guest. Gilly, would you read to us, please?
Yes, I'd love to. Excuse me. I'm born and brought up in India, and it very much informs my thinking. I miss it very much. This is called Bombay Banyan. From where I dangled my feet in the heat shimmer, the cliff fell away into a haze over the city's skin. A seersucker of raised domes and temple sikaras. The buildings exploded by flame trees and foliage. The view was framed by a banyan, roots growing down into the golden air, and creaking palm leaves, where the hooded eyes of vultures peered through air speckled with fast birds and paper kites. On the rocks below, dobies thwacked a syncopation with washing that later would be stretched to dry in a basking, sun-broiled motley. A cacophony grappled its way up to us. Dogs, crows, cries, chants, the brain fever bird's rising scale, the shush-shush of whisk brooms, forever unsettling the dust. A midden of smells singed the air. Sewage, spices, jasmine and sandalwood, cooking fires and cow dung. At Diwali, oil lamps outlined every contour of the city. Fireworks fountained and fizzed above the street lights. A hoard of jewels poured at our feet. Greater splendour than any Queen Empress could unclasp and carry off. And then I was torn off and sent to England to be taught how to be a young lady. Did you live in a mud hut? They asked. And that's true, they did.
Lovely.
Time when people didn't travel as much as they do now, and they really did think that. This one is called Master of Gossamer. Oh, big scary spider in a corner of the steppe, why do you cower there behind a weed? Don't you know how much in awe of you we are? the way you float from egg to sticky leaf, swing across the bush, fly from tree to tree, abseil lightly down the highest walls. We too want to dance tightrope across the moon, drop from an empty sky, weave larders in the air. Only when you stand defiant in the white expanse of the bathtub are you vulnerable. Some of your eyes on the plug hole, some on the tap, but most on the screaming giant who might transfer you to the window, from where you could lasso the wind. And
couple more, please.
Okay. This one is a sonnet, and I wrote it in my garden in Peckham. Twilight Shuffle. Slow clouds of indigo and coppered gold steal light away from summer's evening sky. The beetle cracks his back. His wings unfold and blur past treetops, humming as they fly. Snails figurehead each shadowed silver trail. Moths dust the print of darkness, seeking light. Small bats curve shallow spirals, rise and sail into the echo chamber of the night. A hunting cat moves softly through the dark. A frog blinks, petals fall, and all sounds cease. Then quiet water splashes, foxes bark. The overgrowth seems settled and at peace. The moving leaves are stilled, but underneath the night shift works with tiny claws and teeth. And this is the last one I have written in the first half. It's called Trash Can Tumbler, and this one is not from the book. This is a newer one. It's, anyway, we'll see. Trash Can Tumbler. In the plush purple cloak I wear at midnight, I go on forays with my favourite cat, who is so fond of Emmental cheese that we always end up by the dustbins of the Swiss Café Quarter. Graceful tumbler of the trash cans, he vaults from stack to stack of stinking rubbish with a determination I find consoling. Such serendipity is in the bins. He tosses aside plastic and paper to disappear among rinds and wrappers sent from the mountains of a pristine state. I caress the £5 voucher I could spend inside, but dissuaded by the confabulation of his onomatopoeic comments, I chuck it in the garbage and hurry after him as he shakes the last lid from his back paws and flicks his disappearing tail up the alley.
Thank you very much indeed, Jenny. What have you got for us, Nick?
So this is a poem I've grown very fond of over the past couple of weeks, since it won a prize from the Penge Festival poetry competition. It's called Shadowlands. I love the shadows, soft and loose, slipping in between the sheets, wrapping with their gentle touch, giving shape, giving form to simple shapes. I love the lack of definition, that otherness as angles shift, the way they clothe our nakedness, add mystery to desire. I love the way they cool the heat, invite a gentle breeze to kiss between the shoulder and the neck, between one moment and the next. And these are the next poems are from my collection that's coming out soon, Playing with the Pieces. This is called Soul. Easy to misplace something so light, or fail to hear her song so quiet. Lost in darkness, shuttered in a time of need, a sprouting tip is lost within the seed. Disinclined to flourish when the ground is hard and dry, you may not see her in the crevice where she hides. So softly seek her gentle whispers in your ear, personal, intrinsic, so you have to strain to hear. She exists in contemplation, brings joy to solitude. Together, you're inseparable. No one can intrude. Search for her in the morning. By the evening, she may glow. And when you die, of course, she shines for everyone to know. This next poem is called Dyspraxia. Dyspraxia is a condition related to dyslexia, but while dyslexics have problems which tend to include word blindness. Dyspraxia is more related to coordination problems. It used to be called clumsy child syndrome back in the non-subtle days. There's a range of symptoms, and most dyspraxics develop very effective coping mechanisms. There are some reasons why I think I may have it, but I don't know. I haven't been tested. Dyspraxia, sonnet number 1100. Just a little bit adrift in time and space, never quite sure of your exact location or direction and rate of travel. Easy to understand Heisenberg when you live his theory every day, keeping time more or less, well, less. Can't seem to get the rhythm right, from one day to the next. Interesting where this leads, this different slant on where we reside, how fixed we are or aren't. Drop your preconceptions to think outside the box that cannot contain you. This is Labels, which is sonnet number 1101. This condition that I might have, I've had this set of symptoms all my life, or might have. I don't know if I want to know if you think I have it too. Who wants a label, especially one that says your brain is different, not quite normal? As if normal actually exists. There are things you will never do, and others that you struggle with, but that's always true, isn't it? Without the label or the stigma, just like we all have things we're good at.
Nick, can I ask, why was that sonnet 1100, the dyspraxia one?
Dyspraxia, as a name also, DCD. And in Roman numerals, D's 500, C's 100, D's another 500. You add them together, you get 1,100.
And why was the next one 1,101?
Because it fires on.
Does it clean all kinds of things?
Yeah, probably. Oh, good. There you go.
Good. Anyway, here we are, more on the domestic level. This is LBC Home Service, or known as Rant Number 4. We have conversations about cardboard. Is it this week they collect the bottles and the tins? Or is it paper only? We slip the cardboard in. I'll check. I think it's only rubbish bins. We converse about tins and plastic bottles. Do we mix them both together or do they go into a separate plastic box? We wash the tins, but not in our machine. We could die of AIDS or vertigo. The postman's late today and the newspaper's been delayed. Due to snowed up a whopping and the trains are all held up. We'd pay the papers weekly as the cost amounts so much. We think the milkman's on the fiddle, but I think that he's corrupt. He's got a website now full of offers, not up to much. Is it one or two pints daily? Have we paid him, dear? Do you know I've never seen him? Oh, I did once when I was late. One of us was drunk and he wasn't very clear. We have conversations about cardboard, about the price of milk going up, and wish that we were teenagers, promenading almost naked in the cold, worrying about important things like records, films and clothes.
Thank you, Ted. Our first piece of music today is a setting of a poem by King James I of Scotland, whose dates are 1394 to 1437, from The King's Quair, the King's Book. The first line of this poem is, "Now was there made fast by the tower's wall." This is a setting of the poem by Jocelyn Pook, and she's recorded the poem backwards, as Pook loves the strange kind of uneasy quality you get. "I find it really peaceful," she says. So this track is actually called Butterfly Song, and it's by Jocelyn Pook. Leaves.
When I was driving along Lewisham Way, I learnt that my vehicle was its tax was hadn't been paid. I know this is true. No, it was the MOT was out of date. I know it was true because the policeman told me it was true. So in honour of that occasion, my favourite poem comes from the South Bank Poetry Magazine. It's written by Fraser Southey and it's called The One-Way System at Lewisham Station. And that is the title, the first line of the poem. The one-way system at Lewisham Station is not one way. There is no system. They are demolishing the station. Local residents are invited to view the master plan on a website that crashed 6 months ago. Welcome to Lewisham Gateway, the homepage once read, to a brave new confluence of well-lit pedestrian walkways, affordable retail outlets, colourful bistros and bustling cafes. Those who cannot wait until 2025 may enjoy elevated views of a bomb site from the delayed 1737 to Dartford.
My favourite poem is The Poet's Ear by Gillian Clarke. The Poet's Ear for Anne Stevenson. Nothing to do with the clamorous city, shouting sotto voce to no one in pubs, parties, shops, and all of us pretending to hear. Nothing to do with the train drumming the viaduct, traffic tuning up at the junction, the Blackstone Cathedral bells in the frozen air. Not wind in the feathering rusts of the motorway angel, singing a note too high to hear, its rasp of red dust in the slipstream of lorries. Nor the small talk of ewe and lamb, or the call of the kite and the crow over Pulky Mark, where high notes are first to go in the labyrinth silence. It is footfall, breath, the heart listening for the line's perfect pitch. It's not Bach, not Schumann, but the mind's cello sounding the depths of the page.
So my favourite poem comes from the former US Poet Laureate, Billy Collins, and it's called Reader. So having a book coming out soon is kind of touches me a little bit more than it would before. Reader. Looker. Gazer, skimmer, skipper, thumb-licking page-turner, peruser, you getting your print fix for the day, pencil chewer, note-taker, marginalist, with your checks and X's, first-time or revisitor, browser, speedster, English major, flight-ready girl, melancholy boy, invisible companion, thief, blind date, perfect stranger. This is me, rushing to the window, to see if it's you passing under the shade trees with a baby carriage or a dog on a leash. Me picking up the phone to imagine your unimaginable number. Me standing by a map of the world, wondering where you are, alone on a bench in a train station, or falling asleep, the book sliding to the floor.
Chilly, please. Your favourite poem?
Impossible to say a favourite poem, but this one I really love because it's set in Bombay. It's by Imtiaz Darker from her wonderful book, Over the Moon, and it's called Hirayath, Old Bombay, and I hope I don't cry while I'm reading it. I would have taken you to the Naz Café if it had not shut down. I would have taken you to the Naz Café for the best view and the worst food in town. We would have drunk flat beer and cream soda and sweated on plastic chairs at the Naz Café. We would have looked down over the dusty trees at cars creeping along Marine Drive, round the bay to Eros Cinema and the talk of the town. We would have held hands in the Naz Café, over sticky rings on the tabletop, knee locked on knee at the Naz Café, while we admired the distant stock exchange, Taj Mahal Hotel, Sassoon Dock, Gateway. We would have nursed a drink at the Naz Café, and you would have stolen a kiss from me. We would have lingered in the Naz Café till the day slid off the map into the Arabian Sea. I would have taken you to Bombay if its name had not slid into the sea. I would have taken you to the place called Bombay, if it was still there. And if you were still here, I would have taken you to the Naz Cafe.
Thank you, Jilly. Another piece of music now. This is another setting of a poem by Jocelyn Pook. The poem is Yellow Fever Psalm by James Stanley Gilbert. And again, the poem has been recorded backwards.
Thank you.
A little question to both of you. You've both got new books to be published. And where? How did you get discovered, let me call it?
After you, Nick.
Well, I was discovered, I suppose.
You were?
It was a South Bank poetry event at the Poetry Cafe in Covent Garden.
Yep.
And there was a open mic bit, and I read three poems. Mm-hmm. And when I came off, I was handed a business card. And 3 weeks later, when I found the business card,
yes,
I found I had a publisher. So,
it's just like that.
Just like that. Yeah. So put yourself out, and maybe somebody will hear it, and you'll get talent spotted. Worth trying.
Jilly, were you talent spotted?
Nope.
Headhunted? Were you headhunted?
No. This was. I made a submission to the Live Canon 2015 first collection competition, mm-hmm. and I was shortlisted. There were four of us. Yeah. Paul Carney, who you had on this program a month ago,
yep.
Was the outright winner, but Live Canon decided to publish all four of us. So that's how that happened. So I'm utterly delighted. Mm. And it was launched on the 21st.
Oh.
Of June, so okay. It is now actually out, and you can get it on, well, either from the publisher Live Canon Press or from Amazon.
How fascinating. Well, and, when you're preparing your book, do you make a theme? Do you put a mixture of sonnets and rondels, or what?
So I've always kind of liked poetry books where there is a theme of some sort, where the poems feed off each other, mm-hmm. and the sum of the parts is more than the individual poems. And I've tried to sort of do that in mind, so it's got a bit of a sort of story through it.
Yeah.
The first part's, you know, life going wrong,
yeah,
everything falling apart, as it does. The second is a sort of journey of knowledge, and then the third part is finding a better place and putting, you know, resolving some of the issues from the first part.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's quite nice. Imtiaz, that you read from, her books, the poems relate to each other,
yes,
through it, and it beautiful the way she does that.
Mm.
Yeah, Julie?
Well, I write off in every direction, really, so I can't say that there's a theme by any means. But Helen Eastman, who's the editor and the publisher, spent a lot of time kind of, you know, we kind of tried to work out an order for them, mm-hmm. and there are four sections. And they do, to me anyway, and obviously to her, or she wouldn't have done it, they do sort of hang together, but it's not... a theme of, you know, like, let's say a theme of love or death or whatever. There are several strands that go through it, and they seem to interweave in a relatively coherent way, I hope. So it's quite a different...
Yeah.
How does... What's the relationship between yourselves and your publisher?
I think I've had a really good relationship with Camilla at Powerwell. She has a much better ear for some of the meter and mm-hmm. you know, just sort of advised me here and there, little bits I could tweak. It's kind of, we need an extra syllable here, or this line doesn't really work.
That's interesting.
And that's been really useful, and it's really helped me a lot. Yeah. And I use that when I write new stuff as well now. I'm sort of doing that for myself. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that was really good. So she's pretty much hands-off, but she, you know, occasionally she'll come up with something and say, don't think this is a sonnet. I think, you know, you need to rework that.
Okay.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, Helen is very hands-off, really. Mm-hmm. And... I mean, she was immensely hands-on with the kind of helping, the ordering and everything. Mm. But she does so much, Helen. She's quite remarkable. She's a Greek scholar, and she's a director, and she's a writer, and she's a million different things. So that may have been part of the reason why she didn't. But she didn't actually change any of the poems as such. But I think her input is very much there in the way they all hang together.
So having a good editor is important in how the book looks at the end as a process.
Yes, I think so. I think she was quite concerned, I'm not sure that's the right word, but the way a poem will look, like, you know, you'll have a short thing with an interesting formatting, and then on the next page maybe a longer thing. And so it's that sort of thing as well, how it comes across visually as well as how it sounds. And I will say, obviously, I mean, quite a lot of my poems I have taken to workshops and stuff like that. So there has been an editing process. And some of them I haven't. Some of them just gone straight in.
Yeah. I did notice, actually, the 2016 poetry competition from Life Canon is open now.
Oh, yes, it is.
So listeners may be interested in that.
I'm sure they will be.
So I suppose you can find it on the Live Canon website.
Yes.
So just type Live Canon into Google or other search engines which are available.
Yes. Live Canon Press, at least, because I think there are some other kinds of Live Canon.
But where are the books available? In bookshops? On the website?
I mean, certainly 154 was is available on Amazon.
Okay, yes. Good one, that, yes.
Yeah.
Can you explain to the listeners what 154 was about?
So basically, it was something that Helen did in far too little time, God knows how.
Mm-hmm. But amazingly,
brilliantly. And she got 154 poets from every continent on the globe, except I don't think there are any Antarcticans. But every other one, she got these poets to write a response to each one of Shakespeare's sonnets.
Yes.
And then publish them. So you've got 154 brilliant poets, brilliant poems by modern poets, and 154 brilliant poems by William Shakespeare.
Yeah, he wasn't bad, that Shakespeare chap, was he?
He was pretty good. I'm not sure 154 of them were brilliant. I think one or two were a little bit ropey. But
and what number is yours?
Of William Shakespeare's. All the modern ones are great. My one is 149.
And mine's 138.
Lovely. And that's Live Canon?
Yes. It is indeed, yes.
Bookshops?
If you go to Amazon, type in 154 in numbers and Live Canon, it'll come up.
Okay. You're coming back to your own bookshop, your own poetry. Self-editing. How do you do it as you go along? Jilly, you write every day, I believe, or very frequently.
I certainly don't have I'm not one of these brilliant people who sort of set aside 4 o'clock to 10 o'clock every morning and write, but I do write quite a lot. I write a lot.
Do you know how many words?
Oh, God.
Kipling used to do something like 4,000 words before breakfast.
Yeah, I know. I'm not that disciplined.
We'd have to have a very late breakfast.
Yes. I go through periods like everybody does when you just can't stop writing, and other times when you just, you know, it's kind of recreating itself and it's...
I'm glad you said that, because some people might think they're suffering from writer's block.
No, it's always working along in there, I'm
good,
sure.
Good. Because, you know, a simple answer to that is that he's right. Yours is working along. Some people think they're getting blocked. All they're going to do is if you write yourself a letter or where you go, and that'll help to unblock you a little bit.
Loads of things.
Self-Eddington.
Self-editing.
Both.
Yeah, I mean, some of mine come perfectly. Initially, not very many. I tend to edit a little bit. Change the old word here and there. You sort of pick them up, you look at them, you tweak them slightly. Sometimes they need an overhaul.
Yeah. You're a regular writer every day?
No, not at all.
No.
There are some days I write 3 on the way to work, and there are some days when I haven't written anything for weeks.
Only write 17.
And then, it comes in waves. Yeah.
But it isn't it?
But I find one of the main things is to read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the more I read, the more I
that kicks
ingest
you off.
Stuff. Yes, and reading it comes out in another way.
Yeah, I'm a great ingester, as such.
It's terribly important.
Just something. Peter, do you ingest?
I ingest all the time, Ted.
But it is terribly exciting when a poem kind of writes itself.
Yes.
And it comes out kind of fully formed and you just watch it happen. It's one of the most wonderful things. But, you know, there's sometimes, I'm sure even you would, you know, sometimes you will find yourself tweaking a poem that you wrote years ago.
Yes.
And others that you'll never touch again, you know.
I found that dangerous. When I've tweaked poems which I wrote years ago, they then lose perhaps the rhythm or the sentiment the way they were written at the time.
Yeah. I always keep the old version and quite often I go, I'll get back to that one.
Yeah,
very important.
I agree. Yes, yeah. Otherwise you can end up with take it to an extreme, you can end up with a totally different poem because...
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, sometimes, which is quite nice as well, because then you've got two for the price of one.
I agree. Sales.
Don't know yet. It's too recent. It's only been out for about a week, so okay. 2 weeks or something.
And yeah, of course.
And of course, I've sold none at all. But then I have to actually get it through the printing process.
I shall speak on behalf of Peter. We shall order one now. How much would it cost us?
Oh, to you, Ted, £50.
Twice as
to anyone else, a lot less.
about under a tenner.
Is it more to have a signed copy?
No less with it.
Probably less, because I'll have spoilt your copy by scribbling on it.
Yes.
I think.
Basically. Would you write in the margins?
I could be one of Billy Collins' marginalists.
If something sparks you off when you're reading a poetry book, do you write in the margins?
No.
No.
I have notebooks. I always have a notebook in my pocket. I write in that.
Yeah. I used to have a notebook, but... I'm a margin man now. Well, come on, we're going to sign off now. How blatant. What a blatant end this is going to be. Okay. Jilly, what's the name of your book?
Swimming Through Marble.
I should have spoken to you about that title, actually. how much?
A penny short of a tenner.
Oh, lovely. And how many pages?
Well, there are 80 poems, I think. I'm not sure how many pages.
A good read by the sound of it.
Why is it called Swimming Through Marble? As Ted isn't going to ask you either.
Because one of the poems in it, which is called Stargate, is about not knowing how to swim through marble, which was a bit clunky for a title. But, you know, swimming through marble is hard, and we do it. So it's kind of a metaphor for life, I suppose. Oh, that sounds terribly pompous, but it's,
And it is a lovely picture on your front cover.
Scorpions. They're fossils of sea scorpions who were caught swimming through marble, but they look really feisty, as if they just kept at it right to the end. So I love that.
Well, just to nip away from your book quickly, you're editing
so
Poetic License.
Yes, Poetic License magazine. We're relaunching that in September.
Yeah.
And... we're sort of extending it a bit to take short stories as well.
Yep.
But if you have a look at www.poeticlicensemagazine.com, there's the instructions for submissions and so on there.
And the name of your book?
Name of my book, Playing with the Pieces. And it's a smidgen less than Jilly's, I think it's a pound less. Wow. It's...
lovely.
Almost as long.
Two contrasting titles, one locked in and one spread about. Thank you both very much indeed. Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. The next piece of music perhaps fits the times. This is PJ Harvey's The Last Living Rose.
Take me back to beautiful England.
Peter Evans will now read the village notices.
Thank you, Ted. Poets Anonymous next meetings are Saturday the 9th of July in the primary room at the United Reformed Church, Addiscombe Grove, East Croydon, CRO 5LP from 2:30 p.m. And then Thursday the 14th of July in Matthew's Yard off Surrey Street, Croydon from 7:30 p.m. So come along and bring your poems and bring lots of poems and read them. And we are back here on Croydon Radio on the 31st of July.
Thanks, Peter. Right, now to wind the programme up. Wind the programme, we've got hours yet. Jilly and Nick are going to give you the full taste of some of their poems. Jilly, please.
Okay. This one is also not in the book, the others are. And it's called And So I Pray. Peril paints the horizon and thuds into the ground while I butter my toast. My soulmates slide to the edge of life. I have no shield to hold over the beloved. No echo returns from the future. The sun turns a dirty London corner and conjures a luminous cityscape from cracks in the concrete. Neglected crannies fill with incandescent dust. Radiance flickers over unsettled faces. So I pray to give the dead the love they deserved, to inhabit, like a hoverfly, my own speck of heaven, for my cat to hurry slowly towards me, my man to touch me for no reason, for the ocean, for the air, for the restoration of love. And the next one is a bit weird. It's called Breakwater. Old Beak went down to the sea below and stood on the crumbling shells, and the sky beat down with a soft pink glow, and he pointed his finger and said, "You know, if you watch the wavelets, the ships will show themselves on the corkscrew swells." So they watched the water and saw the sun pass under the harbour walls, and the ships bobbed up and their sails bobbed down, and everyone watched from the tumbling town, waiting to recognise some of their own swing round the floating bells. They all came home and docked their craft and climbed ashore with a smile. But Beak still pointed and never laughed, just stood there muttering, "Don't be daft. There's bodies adrift on a makeshift raft far out on a nautical mile." The townsfolk gasped and ran for the boats and pushed them into the bay. They struggled into their caps and coats, turned the capstans and threw the ropes, sailed past the dangerous days of hope, and all of them vanished away. Old Beak stood silently in the night among all the empty souls, and they watched for the comfort of one small light to break the darkness and prick the sight. But the sea was hissing with fish in flight from the sucking of black, black holes. And this is my last. Oh, no, it's not my last, is it? Sorry about that. Under the Garden, this is called. She drew back the curtain. The growing green world reached out towards her and tapped at the glass. She opened the casement, but who was invited? Breath from beyond or the body within? Caressing her cheek, small green shoots unfurled tight spirals, fresh as new morning grass. Touched on her brow and her lashes, alighted butterfly soft on her humming skin. Sun-warmed and loosening tendrils curled, flickering, seeking a way to pass into shadow behind her ear, delighted the nape of her neck with a shiver of sin. Wrapped close about her, the greenery whirled her about and around in a deadly volte-face, tightened about her body, excited an agonized breathing, an uncertain grin. Now under the garden she lies, her hair pearled and plaited with creepers, dry-fallen and sparse. Among their small bones with her loves reunited. All cold in the clay. They are kith, they are kin. And this is a last short poem called Starlight. Paint stars on the inside of my coffin. Let it be lightly woven to welcome the evening breeze. Lay me in feathers and memories strewn with petals and rosemary. But do not burn or bury me. Carry me on a moonless night to an ocean brimming with starlight. Leave a window above my face opening on the vault of space. Walk with me through the shallows where little fish shall bind me in rainbows. float me to the reef wall, and let me fall through peaceful shoals of manta rays into the sway of darkness.
Wonderful. I'm poetry fixed.
I'm speechless, which is unfortunate because it's my turn, isn't it?
I'm going to busk it through for the next so many.
So the poetry in my book addresses some quite serious themes on physical and mental health. But overall, I hope it's very much about seeking answers and about hope and recovery. This is called After a Period of Absence, and it's sonnet number 155, which is the average length in millimetres of a wagtail, according to my bird book. Escape into this world again, a world renewed with a sprightly wagtail, darting over water, bobbing every step, every beat of her tiny heart. What was I thinking in those spirals? What was I sinking ever further into? I'm happy not to push the point past what comes unbidden. Just retain enough to mark the path and turn away towards the flash of yellow, the slate grey back as soft as hope, the darting beak and dipping tail, tip to tail in every instant, whole, complete and delicate as only life can be. These next three poems are dedicated to my friend Ken and are about coming to terms with a rather dramatic change to our relationship. So Off to the Pub, sonnet number 13, for Ken. There were things that we could only say in the early hours of the morning, outside the gates of a school that neither of us had ever attended, on the way back to your place for coffee and more chat. Whatever it was we spoke about, it kept us sane. But there were interruptions. My girlfriend, your girlfriend, your girlfriend, my wife, your suicide. Can we talk about that? This is a state of not knowing, also for Ken. It took me years to come to terms, decades to forgive you for blaming her, for leaving us that way, on the path between hatred and despair. You should never have left that note. You were always much better than that. But then I never read your words, only heard second-hand reports. Maybe you only tried to explain how you came to feel so low. So much your family kept from us, even the method of your death. Years later, when I was looking for a flat, the agent showed me yours. Not knowing, he offered me the chance to live where you died, to be where you bled, to breathe where you suffocated, bathe where you drowned, eat where you poisoned yourself, to sleep with your ghost. And this is Forgiveness, sonnet number 2, again. Patting pockets, I feel the edge of keys before closing the flat door behind me, descending past my neighbour's doors. My customary taking of the evening air leads me where paving stones run down to the witness of calm lake waters, between the slanting branches and the dusk. So we walked together yesterday, you offering your good advice for all my current concerns. Today we smile, sharing passing observations, remembering our better days before I turn for home. This is the way of it, between old friends, the present and the past. And this poem is about my friend Glynn's therapy for her OCD. It's called Learning to Swear, Learning to Let Go. Leaving the bathroom with the tap on, water running, overflowing, anything bad could happen. Anything bad will happen, has happened. Already the firemen are coming. The firemen will evacuate the building. The building will be flooded. The firemen will drown. No knowing what could happen, what will happen, has happened. Such reckless abandon, such flagrant disregard. There are rules about such things. Rules that keep us safe. Repeat the rules. Retrace each step. the tap is running down the drain. Next week we leave the building, go outside to busy streets, walk down crowded London roads, and we shall be instructed to expleet, told to swear in public, uttering profanities loudly, talking rudely more than once. You probably think this is amusing. You may think this is funny. Perhaps you should reread it. It may help to make you understand. Keep a count, add one to it. If the count is less than 50, read the page again. 1. Learning to swear, learning to let go. Leaving the bathroom with the tap on, water running over, flowing, anything bad could happen, anything bad will happen, has happened. Already the firemen are coming, the firemen will evacuate the building, but fortunately, it's my friend Glyn who has OCD and not me, so I don't have to read that poem 50 times to you. By all means, read buy the book, read it 50 times to yourself. But the idea is that you swear at some point and then you can get out of it. Partly why it's called Learning to Swear, and partly, of course, because that was in his therapy. Do I have time for one more?
Short one.
Okay, very short one. This is called And Now. This present time is such a gift. There will never be another time like this. Balanced between whatever will be fated and whatever it was that has already been, lies this single moment, forever recreated. In it alone, the very stuff of life is seen.
Nick, thank you very, very much. And Jilly, thank you very, very much. And thank you for listening. And Peter, for flying us to wherever we've been.
Thank you, Ted. And the final piece of music today is setting of 19th century Icelandic poetry. This is Brennastjarna or Stars Burn by the band Samris. And thank you for listening.